I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. About 60 years ago, a couple of Australian poets decided to play a rather cruel prank on Max Harris. He was a man in charge of a poetry review called Angry Penguins. Max Harris was like every editor then and now. This man lived with the hope that he would be the one to discover the next great poet. So the pranksters invented their own poet. They called him Ern Malley. They cobbled together a collection of poems and sent it all off to this unsuspecting editor who took the bait in spectacular fashion, publishing the poems and the woeful tale of the poet. When the hoax was revealed, the Australian media seized on it, and the subsequent publicity, followed by a trial for obscenity, were all but the end of Max Harris and his magazine, Angry Penguins. It's a great story. And it's also been the jumping-off spot for another great story, this one by the Booker Prize-winning author Peter Carey. Carey takes the bones of the Ern Malley affair to build an even stranger tale, in which it's hard to know if the invented poet is real or not. And that's where we'd like to have you join our conversation today. What is it that fiction can do when it's based on a little piece of history? Not unfamiliar terrain for Mr. Carey. Is the author constrained by the facts, the truth of the original story? Or can the author help us see the world in a different way by urging us to question what we thought was true? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter Carey's my guest this hour. His new book is called My Life as a Fake. Welcome to the studio.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Nice to have you here. How well known is the Ern Malley affair in Australia?
Probably the truth is that it'd be known by literary people of a certain age. Unlike another story which I use, Ned Kelly. Now, the story of this outlaw Ned Kelly is something that's known to all Australians. But in the case of Ern Malley, a much smaller number, very important to writers and readers, as I said, probably over 40.
And in fact, Ern Malley, or the character Ern Malley, has been the subject of a book by Michael Haywood, a friend of yours.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, Michael was writing that book in New York City when I first arrived in New York about 13 years ago. And I spent a deal of time with him reading that manuscript, making the odd suggestion and so on. And it's probably from that time that I really started to think it might be an interesting thing to do a novel about.
What was it about the story that gave you that hint that there was a novel there as well?
Well, I think the one thing that's hard to understand when you're writing a nonfiction piece about this is the degree to which the character of Ern Malley, the invented poet, has come to life, and that this character really does exist in the Australian imagination or the imagination of certain readers. For me, it's not just because of the hoax, and it's not just because of the nature, you know, of the poetry that was produced, but the hoaxers invented these sort of rather wonderful letters because to plant the bait before the editor, they had to come from somewhere, and they decided that it had come from they invented a sister for the dead poet, and she was a woman of no spectacular education or taste, but who writes that really sort of particular Australians will recognise a voice, a very sort of whiny sort of lower middle class voice. So she writes a letter that goes, "Dear Mr. Harris, my brother Ern recently passed away. You know, and I found these poems under his mattress. I don't know whether they're any good or not," and so on. And it goes all the way through to her enclosing 1.5 penny postage, you know, for return postage and so on. And
the editor had to believe in the sister, really, in order to believe in the poet.
Yes, a very important point. And the sister's beautifully drawn. I don't know if you know the Australian comedian Barry Humphreys, who's made a whole career of inventing these sort of characters. He's a great Australian artist. This character, Barry Humphreys, could have drawn. And it's because of that, and because we can imagine from the basis of that letter, if you read it, you can imagine the street in which she lives. You can imagine all sorts of little details, like, you know, these two little concrete tracks down towards the little garage for the little car that would be, and so on. So much detail comes with that. So the result of all of this, we have the poetry on the one hand, which is truly remarkable. And after all, it's meant to be written by a 24-year-old. So 24-year-olds can be occasionally a little pretentious and deliberately obscure. And on the other hand, this whole class background. So we know who O'Malley is in a way. And that's, you know, when to write a non-fiction book about that, you can sort of make that point. But my feeling is that this invented poet had come to life. And the interesting, his had been sort of vindicated in history, because you see these two hoaxers who politically, certainly on the right, and in matters of cultural politics on the right as well, had written, of course, a great body of poetic work, but no one really reads it anymore, you see. And the only... So the hoaxer's poetry is not read anymore, but O'Malley's work is read. And if you went out now and you managed to find in Boston a bookshop that had anthologies of Australian modern verse, you would be likely to find the poetry of O'Malley in there.
Not as if the editors actually still think that O'Malley existed, but because he took on such real life in the imagination of Australians that the poetry of this imaginary poet is included.
Yes, and because somehow I think the hoaxing poets, in spite of themselves, inhabited a persona. They became in that sort of mad moment O'Malley. They wrote these poems, and the poems, we would judge, have worth. And as I said before, particularly if you think the person's 24 years old, which is the persona, they're extraordinary.
Now tell me something about the two poets, Lieutenant James Macaulay, Corporal Harold Stewart, who devised this. Do you admire them for what they were able to achieve?
I think the truth is that one of the reasons I wrote this book is I really always disliked them, and another famous Australian poet, A.D. Hope, who took such malicious glee in bringing down Max Harris. And it seemed to me that at a very profound level, you know, they really were the enemies of art. And Max Harris, no matter what his pretensions or vanities, was a friend of art and artists and pushing through into the future. So one of the emotional engines for me in this book is to say, okay, these are people that are despicable, but look, you know, O'Malley has in some way won in spite of them, and Max Harris has in some way won in spite of them. But you see, when you get into fiction, it's sort of different, because if I begin with this great animus against the hoaxers, when I get into writing fiction, my hoaxer is really ultimately the most tragic figure, and the one for whom I probably have the greatest love and concern for, because he is...
This is why I asked you the question, because in My Life as a Fake, I actually grew quite to like Christopher Chubb, who is kind of mushed together as the single hoaxer.
Yes.
In this one, and I think you do too.
Yes, well, absolutely. He is certainly punished big time, and I think ultimately is elevated morally by this experience.
I'm going to ask you to read a page from My Life as a Fake, and this is the point, Peter, where Mr. Chubb, he has just encountered Sarah Woe Douglas, who's the rather prim editor from a British poetry review. He's just met her in Kuala Lumpur and is about to put the poem in front of her. Have I set that up properly?
Yeah, I think so. Very delicately, he removed the plastic sheath, folding it so particularly that my eyes were held, and I really paid no attention to the treasure it had protected, not until the owner brought it to my attention. It was a poem, or part of a poem, composed in those thick, rhythmic downstrokes which would later become, if only briefly, so familiar. "May I pick it up?" I said. "The tropics are not kind to paper," he said. And indeed, the page showed the signs of both mould and water damage, having become so very fragile that it seemed likely to break in half or even shatter. It looked to have been sliced from a bound journal. "Read, mem, read." And I did so, and I doubt it needs saying that I read with the full consciousness of the old man's history. I approached these 20 lines with both suspicion and hostility, and for a moment I thought I had him. It was a sort of a Oriental Tristan Zara, but that was too glib a response to something with very complicated internal rhymes, and unlike Zara, nothing felt the slightest bit false or old-fashioned. It slashed and stabbed its way across the page at once familiar and alien. I wondered if the patois, Malay, Urdu, was disguising something as common as Cod Elliot. But that did not fit either, for you really cannot counterfeit a voice. All I knew now, in my moment of greatest confusion and suspicion, was that my heart was beating very fast indeed. Rereading the fragment, I felt that excitement in my blood, which is the only thing an editor should ever trust. "Who wrote this?" I asked. I must have looked frightfully stern, but in fact I was all a twitter. "Where's the rest of it?" He removed his spectacles, rubbed his eyes, and sighed. "Oh, shit," I thought. "Of course, it's him. It must be him. You wrote this?" "No, no, not me. Is the author a secret? You will not believe me, mem." "I should like to know," I said. "It is," he said, "a man named McCorkle."
That's Peter Carey reading from his new book, My Life as a Fake. And there was a time, Peter, when you thought you'd tell the story not through the first-person character of Sarah, though she doesn't dominate them. She shares the storytelling duties with others in the book. Mm. But you thought you'd be able to do it with the poet himself, the fictional poet Bob McCorkle.
Well, yeah, my whole thing was, you know, here is McCorkle. He's come to life. The age of 24. What does that feel like? And so then the notion then of him telling the story, and actually imagining what it might be like to be born at the age of 24 in the backyard of a, you know, suburban house, and to discover that you'd been conceived as a joke, and that when you went out in the street, everyone told you were a fake, seemed to me, I mean, it was very, very engaging. And I had a lot. I thought, this is obviously the way to do it, and I spent, you know, 6 months or more, you know, writing it this way, and that you certainly do get from that character. I mean, some of this, that work is still in the book, because it's from that point that the character of McCorkle is really invented. But to have him facing this sort of dilemma in that way, I thought to be, you know, funny and original and so on. The trouble with it in the end was, I realized, it took me forever to realize this, that if you are going to write from that particular point of view, facing the problems of a man born at the age of 24, then you really are going to, the book really tends to want to be about how he learns to be in the world, you know.
Which is not the story that you want to tell.
I didn't want to tell that story, yeah. No. Literature always precedes it for me anyway in this series of misunderstandings, mistakes, you know, false steps. And so it was with great reluctance, it was worse than reluctance, because after a certain period of time, I realized no matter how much I sort of fiddled with it and tried to fix it up and so on, that I would never make it right. And so I knew one night I had to throw it away. And it was the most worst night of my writing life.
Although the next day, as Peter will tell you when we come back after the break, was one of the sunniest. He found a new voice for My Life as a Fake. Peter Carey is my guest. 1-800-423-8255, the number to join our conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Peter Carey is director of the MFA program and a professor of English at Hunter College in New York. He spends a lot of time writing, though. He's one of only two writers to ever win the Booker Prize for Fiction twice. The other one, for those keeping score, is J.M. Coetzee. He, that is Peter Carey, is the author of 8 novels and a collection of short stories. The two that won the Booker, Oscar and Lucinda, and True History of the Kelly Gang. This hour, we're talking about a brand new book called My Life as a Fake. And, Peter, I have to tell you that when I read the book, I try to do this as often as I can, and that is not look at anything, but just sort of start reading. And I read it and was somewhat sort of puzzled and exhausted and exhilarated at the end. And I get to this little thing at the end that says, hey, there is a true story here. You did that on purpose, didn't you? You didn't want to say, this is a novel based on a true event which happened some 60 years. You wanted to kind of draw me into it first as a reader of a novel.
That's the, for me, that's the ideal way for the book to be read. And weirdly, it happens in this case of this book, it happens best outside of Australia, where, you know,
oh, of course,
where when people come to the book in Australia, they're bringing with them all of the stuff about the historical hoax and so. And in a funny way, it makes it hard for them to relax into the fiction. So one of the lovely things about publishing the book in North America, where the story is not known, is you can have this, I hope, pleasant experience of going into this, you know, very made-up world and coming out at the end of it and discovering that some of the more insane things in the story actually did happen. And things that you think I must have made up, like there's a transcript from an insane court case in there, are really taken from transcripts of a real trial. So
our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And listeners, what is it about fiction based on a piece of history that makes it work? Is the author constrained by the facts or the truth of the original story? We'd like to have you join us, 1-800-423-TALK. You don't ever feel constrained by what it is that you work with, do you?
Well, I think it's a complicated issue. One does feel certain sorts of constraints. In this book, because I'm having a Frankenstein-like, Frankenstein's monster sort of character come to life, I think everybody's going to get into that and realize pretty much this is, you know, I'm playing, this did not really happen. So I think that's a relatively liberating thing in the case of this particular story. The previous book, True History of the Kelly Gang, I did put the words true and history next to each other in a rather ironic sort of a way, I thought, because, you know, the minute you put true and history next to each other, it has to be a novel. But I was very careful, I think, that when a bit of history was known, I really wanted to respect it because it's part of a national story and people know it. And I do that not only for sort of fine moral reasons, sort of questions of the truth, but because I'm telling a story to people who know a story. So I, in the bits of the stories that are not, that's known, I want to sort of agree with them. But what I'm interested in then is inventing out in the dark the things that historians can never know and so on. And in that case, I would hope to invent outrageously, but perhaps in the service of what I would might imagine to be the truth and to do with that, to produce a sort of a thing of questioning, to think, oh, we never imagined that this was possible about this story. And then for the readers thinking about that particular history to think, well, maybe he didn't imagine it the right way, but maybe there are other ways of imagining this that are possible. And I think that's an interesting way to think about history.
I like the review that John Updike gave you when he said, you know, all this obsession over what's real and what's not, for goodness sake, we're talking about fiction. Yeah. Nothing's real in fiction.
Well, I know. I mean, I often say, I mean, this sounds a bit grandiose to say it, but there you go, what the hell, I'm going to say it anyway. I mean, who goes to Shakespeare to find out what really happened? Are you going to read Richard III to find out what happened? No, you're not. You don't even expect that. So I think that's really the ultimate defense of the practice of art, you know, that you're making something up.
I want to go, I scribbled something down as you were reading earlier, and it's a line from the reading. You really cannot counterfeit a voice. I mean, the voice of Peter Carey is very much in the voice of Sarah there, because that's, of course, one of the things that I think lights you up about writing more than anything else, is just seeing how far you can go in doing precisely that, counterfeiting a voice.
Well, it is true. Actually, I was thinking while I was reading it how to read out loud does so often subvert everything I wanted to do, because here I've spent all this, a number of years producing Sarah's voice, and that's the voice of a posh English woman. And here I am reading it on air, And so I'm not a woman, and I'm not posh, and I don't sound like her. So in a funny way, I think I'm destroying my own work. But yes, I love.
But don't you think people completely set that aside? I mean, in every storytelling exercise, you'll sit here. And let's go to another one here. Not when Sarah reads McCorkle, but. Which is the one that would be fun. Oh, I know the one. From page 101, when the maid comes to the hotel room with the suit. You know the one that I'm talking about?
I
because this is where you get to play with voices. And first, you know how you finish a book and a scene sticks in your head? Mm-hmm. We were thinking, well, what should we get him to read? And I said, well, this scene stuck in my head. I don't know why, but maybe it's the way that you play with the voices here. Do you need to set this up for us, what's happening?
Well, I mean, Chubb's living in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. Sarah's come visiting. He wants to tell the story. This is happening in Sarah's hotel room. And Chubb has arrived in a filthy, filthy suit. And Sarah is
Chubb. Just a reminder for our listeners: is the fellow who is the hoaxer in this, the person who is carrying around the work of the imagined or not so imaginary poet, and Sarah is the one who's desperately hoping to include this in her British Literary Review.
And she sent out the suit for cleaning. In Kuala Lumpur, there was a loud knocking on my door. Slater, I thought, and made to receive him in rather belligerent fashion, swinging open the door to discover no one more offensive than a slim Malay maid who was delivering Chubb's suit in her extended arms. She had a slightly swollen mouth and lovely slow eyes, a combination which has always been conflated, in my mind anyway, with desire. "Very sorry." "Not at all," I said. After all, this hardly seemed an excessive amount of time to revive a filthy old tweed suit, not in a hotel where one could easily wait 30 minutes for one's coffee. I held out my hand to receive the garment, but she was determined to bring it inside. As she did so, Chubb spoke to her in halting Malay. She answered, rather sharply, I thought, without looking at him. She laid the suit on the bed and lifted the skirt of plastic with her slender finger. "Too much old," she said to me, "you see." I noticed only that the herringbone was green and white rather than black and grey as previously. I could not think what to say. The lovely young woman's eyes then became fierce and accusatory, and I felt a familiar, odd, old disappointment. I'd never been good with servants, not even when we had a dozen of them, and I had inherited from my mother a great passion not to upset them in case they gave their notice for no good reason. I directed my gaze where the maid wished, at the same time searching desperately in my purse. I've always been awful with tipping. At Christmas, I didn't mind it, because those sums had long ago been decided by my father, and it was more of a tradition than that American habit which is calculated to reduce all one's servants to the status of beggars. "You see," she said. I held out a blue note, but could tell I had insulted her. Chubb now came to my side, and I asked him how much should I give. He did not answer, but reached down to the suit, and I finally understood, watching him stroke the lapel, that the process of cleaning had so shocked the fabric that it was now broken on the creases, papery and crumbling in his hand like the wing of a dead butterfly. "It was very old," he said. He draped it across his arms. "Excuse me." It was the catch in the voice that made me look directly into his welling eyes. He carried the suit into the bathroom, a strange, pathetic creature with his tattered shirt, his ulcerated legs, his shining female sarong. Neither the maid nor I knew exactly where to rest our eyes.
That again is Peter Carey reading from his new book, My Life as a Fake. Why Kuala Lumpur? What is it about Malaysia that you thought would work as a setting for this? I'm charmed by your description of that place. In particular, it smells. I find you do that very well. But I wanted to ask you why you decided on Kuala Lumpur.
Well, you know, I think Malaysia or Malaya, you know, as it was then, seems very exotic, you know, from the distance of New York City or Boston or whatever. But if you live in Australia, it really is. It's a long way, but it is next door. I mean, it is part of the region. I mean, it's no accident, you know, that when there was a bombing in Bali, a lot of Australians were killed. I mean, it is out neck of the woods. So it's less exotic to us than it might be here.
But 1972, though, Peter, I mean, this was before all the glass shopping malls of Kuala Lumpur, the Petronas Towers and stuff like this. This was a much more Asian city.
Well, it was. And actually, you know what? There's another reason, too, of course, is I happen to have been there in about 1972 myself. And actually, I wanted to live there, and I liked it. So there's another reason. Sometimes you just want to write it. You're setting it there because you like it. But there's another reason as well. And, Well, when I was thinking about this book and all of the different storytelling factors that might work, it seemed to me that it was important. Well, I had a little echo with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and I, you know, where Frankenstein's monster is seen leaping from icy crag to icy crag around Mount Blanc, and I thought, well, if this was Australia, it would be somewhere more tropical. And then I also thought I rather liked the idea of the invented poet being born and not knowing the names of things and being upset by this and then going off to another country where he's going to learn the names of things. And I thought of him going into a sort of a rainforest environment where there are so many unnamed species and so on. So there's lots of reasons that sort of, and I wanted a chase, and he kidnaps Chubb's child, and there's this chase. And then it's sort of natural, because actually I've done this trip too, that you had to think of going through you know, Bali and into Java and up to Sumatra and across to Penang and down to Kuala Lumpur. It's a sort of a little path that one can imagine. And so all of these factors are dancing around in my mind on the day when I realized my old way of doing it was dead. I wasn't going to be able to write it from the, you know, perspective of you know, the invented poet as a first-person narrative. And what I remembered on that day was being in some town in Malaysia, I don't know which one it was, not Kuala Lumpur, and walking along a street and looking into a Chinese shop house and seeing in the midst of a Chinese Malay family, this old white man with ulcers on his legs and sitting in a plastic chair and with a dirty sarong.
So see? Chubb exists.
And I thought, remembering this, I thought, oh my God, that's Chubb. That's what's become of him. And when I thought that was really the moment of really this way of telling the story exists. And of course, then Sarah and her friend, the poet John Slater, walk past, you know, and that's where it starts. So, and I thought, my God, you know, I can't really write about Malaysia. I'm not from there. You know, all these things. I mean, I have the same sort of feelings about writing Sarah's voice. You know, I'm not a posh English woman. Can I do this? But the fact that it's also a little difficult and maybe I'm not meant to do it, it also makes it attractive to me.
Well, it's easier for anybody from one of the former colonies to take aim at the mothership.
Well, we have a complicated relationship, it's true.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Gloucester, Massachusetts, and Rufus is with us. Rufus, thanks for calling.
Hi. Actually, this is Peter Carey calling. This is the real Peter. The man in your studios are fake, and the reason I've sent him in is because I wanted to emphasize a point about authenticity. He seems like the real thing. He's doing a good job, but I'm actually phoning him from Gloucester, and well, he's just a mate of mine. And no, I'm just kidding, of course. But one of the things that
very good though. Well,
it wasn't a bad crack at the accent.
I've never tried one before, but well, that guy, that crocodile wrestler's got us all speaking this way. Anyway, one of the things that I'm interested in this novel is what I just sort of pointed up, which is the nature of authenticity. And I wonder if Mr. Carey, what he did with the poetry, is it authentic poetry in the novel? Do we actually read any of the poems by this cobbled up this poet who's cobbled them up?
There are two parts to the thing, is because of course it's always very frustrating when you see a movie or read it and somebody's meant to have been a painter, you can a great painter, and of course the director will either decide to let you see the painting or not. And if you see the painting, it's almost always awful, and that lets down the illusion. And if you don't, you feel cheated. So what I decided to do with this in this case is I did both of those things. But the poems that we know about from the beginning, from the hoax, I actually took the original hoax poems that the hoaxers made in Australia in 1943 and gave them to my invented poet, McCorkle. So there is a way in which you can, you know, the reader, you know, actually does experience the work. And for me, I sort of really like the notion of these poems which have existed in one way as a then become embedded in another sort of narrative where they mean other things and are read in different ways.
Yes.
But
are they decent poems? Are they good?
Yeah. You know, well, read the book. I think, you know, they are meant to be the work of a 24-year-old. I think the very first one is really seriously a good poem, and all of them, because they are written by poets of some, you know, technical ability, work very well. And some of them
I get
really
you
thrilled.
To give Rufus just a few lines from one of the poems that appears?
I read it so badly. You see, that's what I'm. But
even in your best BBC English,
not my BBC. So this is. I had often cowled in the slumbrous heavy air, closed my inanimate lids to find it real, as I knew it would be, the colourful spires and painted roofs, the high snows glimpsed at the back, all reversed in the quiet, reflecting waters. Not knowing then that Jura perceived it too. Now I find that once more I have shrunk to an interloper, robber of dead men's dreams. I had read in books that art is not easy, but no one warned that the mind repeats in its ignorance the vision of others. I am still the black swan of trespass on alien waters. And I should say that that's written in it's a reference to an engraving of Jura's of a town in Germany where the poet is saying that he's already imagined it and so on.
The black swan.
And the black swan is
a very Australian symbol.
Yes,
right?
The black swan is not a made up thing. Australian swans are black. And so that line, the black swan of trespass in alien waters, I think is really a beautiful line.
And I think well read, too, and the rest is nearly silence after that, except for a second question, which then I'll take the answer off the air if you care to answer it, and that is when reading the piece itself, when I get to your... Well, I know the poems that you've cobbled are all the poems from the individual, and then... in the first excerpt that you read, you had your editor say that you can't counterfeit voice. Do you agree with the editor there?
Well, it's my job to counterfeit voice.
So that's the way the writer gets to take on the editor. They don't always agree. Rufus, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join my conversation this hour with Peter Carey. We're talking about his new book, My Life as a Fake. More of you, I think, will be familiar with True History of the Kelly Gang and the voice of Ned Kelly. And this one takes us to another country and a completely different understanding of what is true and what is real and what is imagined and how we're all supposed to make sense of that. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Peter Carey is with me in the studio. We're talking about his new book, My Life as a Fake. And the fake at the center of the story is a poet who either exists or doesn't exist. He is created, but then he becomes real. And I'm drawn to ask you whether or not you ever really made up your mind as the storyteller, whether or not this fake poet, Bob McCorkle, was real or not.
Oh, I've always believed... The one thing, all the things that it was clear about in the book, is that he actually had definitely come to life.
You have to say that as the writer, don't you?
No, but I mean, it's my beginning. You see now, but then having decided that, which of course, I've always been really interested in the power of the imagination, or even the power of stories, or the lies we tell ourselves, and that I've always. I have a sort of a magical thinking, which I think is not uncommon among novelists. You know, that if you the experience of having said something and then later seeing it come true in life to some degree, or the magical feeling that you might say something and it might come true and so on. So, I have a novel, Illywacker, which is actually all about, a confidence man, a lie, and the lies that he tell do come true. So it's an old issue for me. So in this case, my notion was these hoaxers have invented this poet, but the poet literally comes to life. And I hadn't thought then of the parallels with Frankenstein's monster, but I thought about them later on, but a similar sort of...
Describe Bob McCorkle, because he's quite a terrifying character. I don't know, was he not intended to be terrifying? I was pretty intimidated by him.
Well, he's very tall and very powerful, great swept-back mane of black hair and a big nose and chin and cheekbones rather Australian working class voice, but an intelligent, but angry, 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 angry. And why wouldn't he be? So I made him big. Really, it was sort of to do, well, I suppose for two reasons. One, to sort of create some sort of parallel with the notion of Frankenstein's monster, but also to sort of give some physical shape to the power of his rage and wish for revenge and so on. So, anyway, I never doubted that he'd come to life. I didn't have any problem with that. I mean, I'm someone that grew up sort of writing stories where people turn into tow trucks. So that seems a much more complicated thing than this to me. But then once I get into the book and I'm writing it not from his point of view, but from Sarah's point of view and other people telling the story, I realize that none of the other characters can possibly believe it. Because if I'm going to tell you the story, you're not going to believe that this really happened. So I've got to work, the structure of the thing is my very firm belief that he's come to life. And all the evidence, I think, is there that he did, but no one can accept it. And even Sarah, who's the one who becomes most obsessed, the editor of the literary magazine, whose life has been so affected by this, comes really to the conclusion that he must have existed, but she can't accept it. And she has a little nervous breakdown in Oxford Street in London because of this. That's what I think. But of course, books are made up by readers, and I can't control that. I can't stop anybody.
Books are made up by readers.
Well, yes. Books don't exist. I mean, books don't exist until the reader reads them, and the reader is the one who, brings them to life. So the reader is in charge of the project, as far as I'm concerned.
But you're the one who puts black hair and a big nose on Bob McCorkle.
Yeah.
And I don't doubt that for a minute. I'm going to sit there and go, well, why? Of course not. See, okay, black hair.
Even if I want to be picky about that, even if you want to think at the, if we had 20 people here in the room and there was a way we could actually see we saw the black hair and the big nose, I'm sure we would all see it slightly differently. And that's why we can never go to a movie of a book we love, because we've already made the movie in our heads. And the what we see on the screen is a sort of a reading by a director who's going to, as far as we're concerned, they're going to have ruined it because we've already done it. So I think it's a beautiful thing about literature that we all make it up. And it's very personal and very passionate.
It must be very strange then to be the person who sits in the writer's chair in the period of time before the readers start to react to the book. And I want to try and set aside the fact that a lot of the reaction is from reviewers, because they're only a peculiar kind of reader. So how does that – I mean, you're in that funny position of being a sculptor, sculpting something that you almost can't really see until someone else sees it.
Well, that's really true. And there's a thing that I often feel, which is to do with the emotional impact of a book on a reader. You see, I begin a book when I'm beginning full of feelings and very passionate about things, but it is inevitably true that in the last stage of fixing this and fixing that in the last draft, one becomes a little bit of a technician or a craftsman so even though one knows the feelings one had and also the feelings one wishes to engender in the reader, one's no longer really feeling them in one's heart. They're not a surprise, mm-hmm. and so on. And so
do you get tired of them, sick of them? Do you want them to go away at that point?
No, I just want them to be right.
Yeah, yeah.
and the thing of going over that and them not being and continually finding things that are wrong, that's what drives me crazy. But and I just want to get it right. So it's always a big surprise to feel the sort of the size of people's emotional response to the story, because one's forgotten quite. And I'm pleased by that, because one fears, because one's got past the stage of feeling as deeply as one did at the beginning. I probably shouldn't admit this, really.
Come on. You put a couple of Booker Prizes on the shelf and you can say, no, I think I know what I'm doing here. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston. Peg's calling in. Hi, Peg. Thanks for calling.
Hi, you're welcome. This sounds like a wonderful novel. I can't wait to read it. I teach a course in Australian cinema here in Boston, and one of the films that we look at is Picnic at Hanging Rock, which is, of course, a novel based on a supposedly true event. And then the film, of course, opens with a little disclaimer that says, it seems to imply it's based on a true event. And in that course, we also talk about Australian literature and Australian modes of storytelling, not just in film, but also in novels and poetry. And we also talk about the work of Thomas Keneally, who also has written novels based on true historical events in Australia, like The Playmaker or Schindler's List. So I'm wondering if the author could comment on, is this an inherently Australian way of looking at things, this idea that, Australia's history being the fascinating thing that it is. Is this an approach that writers take trying to embellish or enchant somehow actual history?
Well, could I, if I could put Picnic at Hanging Rock to just to one side for the beginning.
Sure.
One of the things, and there's a line in, and forgive me quoting myself, there's a line at the beginning of True History of the Kelly Gang where I think the narrator, Ned Kelly, says something like, I was raised on lies and silences. Mm. And I think that if one is Australian, and one might feel this in many other countries too, that we're really aware of having grown up with a lot of lies and silences about so many things. Not least the dispossession of the indigenous people, but also really what it might mean to begin the life of Australia as a penal colony, forefathers and foremothers to have been cast out and wrenched away from, they didn't want to be there. They weren't seeking religious freedom. They were sent there. And so there's a whole lot of things that I think that many of us are sort of thinking, well, that story we were told really isn't the right one. And maybe we should, wonder how the story might be. And we also are in the very privileged position as of, a younger country than this one, of being able, the writers of my generation and following generations are in the position of being able to sort of put things on the map, almost name things for the first time, and
participate
in forming
the history,
a culture and making a history. So I think that's something that I don't know. I can't. I mean, Tom Keneally, I know, like, admire. I can't speak for him about this, but that's something that I've always felt to be a great privilege with what I do. And Picnic at Hanging Rock, I'm not sure that it really. Peg, you can probably tell us about Picnic at Hanging Rock, because I think that didn't really happen.
I've seen it about 20 times. So,
I can't really comment on that.
Peg, thanks for your call. I'm sitting here listening to you describe the history of Australia as that of a bunch of convicts who didn't want to be there, and wondering if it really extends through generations, whether or not that's still part of the sort of founding DNA of non-Aboriginal people from Australia. You still feel that or sense it in a way?
Well, it seems peculiar, doesn't it? I mean, for instance, the number of people who were convicts, they were soon in a minority, and as the settlement of Australia increased, very few people descended from them. There's been huge waves of immigration, particularly since the Second World War. So what was once sort of a white, dominantly white Anglo-Saxon Celtic sort of country, is now absolutely multi and wonderfully diverse and multicultural. So how could it be then that the trauma of the First Fleet and the convict continued to affect us? Well, you look at this country, you look at the Mayflower. How many people are descended from the people who get off the Mayflower? Well, they'll tell you, I'm sure, but
how many people in this country will repeat the principles of the Puritans or the Founding Fathers as the ethos that they choose to live by?
Yes, I mean, it's a strong thread in contemporary American life, I would suggest. Similarly, the folks that got off our boats had certain values and issues and problems and opportunities, and that affects us today still too. It's not strange that it should. It's a very short period of history we're talking about, and the other great trauma, and it really is one. The dispossession of the Aboriginal people is something that also affects and shapes us and causes all sorts of things of guilt, denial, and rage in equal parts. As an undealt with issue, is still also forming us.
You have lived in New York City now for what? For some 14 years, is that right? Do you become any less Australian for your long period of servitude in New York City?
I really don't know.
I'm sure people in Australia have views on that.
Well, I think everybody thinks, you're going to become an American, which is about the worst thing that they can probably think, fate that they can imagine for you, probably. I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things you can always, you know, rely on in writers is enormous self-absorption. And one of the things I've always thought about living in New York City is that every day I'm thinking, why are they like that? And why am I like this? So there's a certain part for me living there, still being obsessed with my own country.
But yeah, I was going to say, because you have this long distance view of the situations and the stories and the people and the characters that you still choose to people your novels with.
I spent part of yesterday back in northern New South Wales on a flooded river. So these things, I think it's not so weird really when you think that, I think for writers the experiences, particularly of childhood and early life, are the ones that, you know, often look at Dickens, you know, that childhood shaped him forever. Not necessarily exactly what he wrote about, but that feeling of abandonment and being orphaned, which he wasn't, of course, but he felt he was, continued to drive us forever. So it's not so weird that I would be continually preoccupied with Australia, which I know a lot more about. I mean, I've lived in New York for 13 years, or 14 years, so I can write a story about New York. But is it going to have the roots my Australian stories will have, and is it going to have the breadth? I don't know. The book I am working on at the moment does actually begin, as I said, by this flooded river in northern New South Wales, but it is coming to New York City, and some of it is going to be set in New York City, so this is...
Have you got the voice right for that one yet, or is there still a possibility of a dramatic shifting of gears halfway through?
I think actually I did get, whether it's the voice, I certainly got the protagonist's character right yesterday, and I'm very happy about that.
We'll look forward to that. Peter, I want to thank you so much for coming in to be part of our program today.
Thanks, Dick.
Peter Carey, author of My Life as a Fake. He is, as I mentioned earlier in the program, two-time winner of the Booker Prize for Fiction. Our program is produced by Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugar. Our interns are Jennifer Giles, Sarah Ligon, and Matt Miller. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.